Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is The True History of the Travelling Wilburys, a 2007 documentary that, if it had actually been released in theatres, would surely be remembered as cinema's greatest crossover event. It is a reworking of footage from May 1988, showing how a supergroup consisting of George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison and Tom Petty set themselves a somewhat familiar task of writing and recording a whole album from scratch in a short time period in front of cameras. The difference here, though, is that the whole experience is much more relaxed despite only having 10 days to complete the project. The camera in question appears to be just a personal camcorder, and crucially, George actually seems totally comfortable and happy. So, Ed, how do we reconcile Let It Be George, someone who was clearly sort of justifiably insecure about being overshadowed and outshone by his bandmates, with Travelling Wilburys George, or Nelson Wilbury as is the pseudonym that he adopts, someone who has grouped together, you know, musical superstars and seems perfectly happy working with his new bandmates without any sense of ego?
So you're comparing this to Get Back. You disguised that very well. I had no idea where you were going.
Did you not? I thought it was quite clear.
No, I'm being sarcastic. I very much could tell.
Fair enough.
The obvious thing is he seems quite at ease with himself, and he seems quite at ease in the company of other collaborators. And I suppose like the obvious conclusion to draw from that is that he doesn't feel under pressure. He doesn't feel like he has to live up to the name of sort of being a Beatle, and he doesn't feel like he's in the shadow of anyone else there. Despite, you know, some of the people there, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, you know, sort of unquestionably, you know, rock luminaries, you know.
Bob Dylan is someone that George was quite clearly a fan of during his time in the Beatles. So it sort of surprises me a little bit that we have, you know, members in this band that have been fans of each other. You know, you got George who's clearly been a fan of Bob Dylan long before they became friends. You've got Jeff Lynne, who's clearly been a fan of George Harrison long before they became friends. Being able to work together and get on, by all accounts, as equals.
Yeah, it does seem that way. It's kind of surprising in this where Dylan just seems such a sort of ready and content collaborator in this. And it's like, I never really think of Dylan as the kind of guy who is collaborative or happy just to sort of get into a room with some other guys and have a bit of a laugh and muck about and make stuff up. You know, he doesn't seem, I don't know loads about Dylan at all, but he doesn't seem like that kind of guy.
I think there's probably a reason for that, which is it's probably embedded in this idea that he deliberately perpetuates an image of himself as someone who's mysterious, yeah, and enigmatic in some way, but actually that's very much down to a musical image that he puts out there.
Yeah, and but yeah, no, he seems, you know, oddly at ease with the whole thing, as does everyone. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of ego in the room, and obviously the Let It Be sessions, there's a lot of ego in the room. Slightly less than we were originally led to believe. You know, Get Back has shown us maybe there was a bit, I mean, you know, things were, everyone was getting on a bit better than we thought, but, you know, there were still egos flying around for sure.
You know, when you watch the Get Back film, my main impression of the dynamic of the Beatles at that point is that they're still a band that are just trying to play together, and I don't necessarily think ego comes into it a huge deal. But George has insecurities.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like I said in that intro, justifiably so. Like, he very quickly gets sidelined, obviously. And, you know, let's not get too much into it because we'll cover Get Back at some point in like a 12-part podcast episode, yeah, extravaganza. But there's obviously issues there with him not feeling like he's been recognised as a songwriter in his own right.
Yeah.
So the intent behind Travelling Wilburys, and particularly in the recording of his first album, as documented in this film, which is to get a bunch of people in a room and write songs all together from scratch,
Yeah. Just
feels at odds with this idea that he gives off in that film, where he, you know, he feels like he needs to prove himself in some way.
Yeah, but I think also in 69, just before those sessions, you know, I mean, he says this in Anthology. He'd just been over in Woodstock with Dylan and the band and just been collaborating with them and seemed to have been sort of accepted as an equal, you know. And then, what does he say? You know, then to have to come back to the winter of discontent with the Beatles, you know. You can completely see that. They're different dynamic. You know, he's just, because this is the stupid thing. I mean, these are, you know, the Beatles are at that point just the most, I don't know about admired musicians, but certainly, you know, the best sort of pop stars in the world. Everyone wants to hang out with them or collaborate with them. But actually, so George individually is just admired by other musicians, I'm sure. But then in the room, when it's just the four of them, he's kind of playing, you know, third fiddle, I suppose.
Do you think it's as simple as when in the Beatles, he's trying hard to prove himself? Outside of the Beatles, there's no need for him to do that because he's a Beatle.
Yeah, pretty much literally
basically
that.
Yeah, so there's the pressure is off in that sense, in that and also at this time, you know, post the Beatles breakup, he very quickly becomes the most commercially successful Beatle,
mm-hmm,
in terms of his solo career. So he gets to prove himself that way. It's almost like he's, you know, you could argue that he might feel like he's proven a point by doing that. So actually that, I don't want to say that during the Let It Be sessions he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder, but you could say that that sort of resolves that a little bit for himself. Yeah. And actually he's just more open to being collaborative with other bandmates again.
Yeah, it seems that way. And I think also he seems to have kind of found a group of people who think about collaboration the same way he does, in that it's actually, it's quite lighthearted. It's not to be taken too seriously. No, and, you know, not so much just the thing about ego, but, I mean, also the Wilburys are very much having a laugh.
Yeah. You know,
like they're deliberately daft lyrics and giving each other Wilbury nicknames and all this. What were you telling me about the sleeve notes? Like, they're sort of
for the first album? The sleeve notes for the first album are, they tell the what's supposed to be the history of the Travelling Wilbury, like they're nomads. It actually says the original Wilburys were stationary people, realizing that civilization could not stand still forever. They began to go for short walks, And he goes on to explain the evolution of that short walk, you know, where they'd go out for lunch and for picnics, and then eventually they'd leave late Friday and come back on the Sunday. And it was just very much tongue-in-cheek. And those whole liner notes were written by Michael Palin.
Yeah.
Obviously, thanks to George Harrison's connections to Monty Python, who gave himself his own pseudonym, which was Hugh Jampton.
Yeah.
Coincidentally, the liner notes for the second Traveling Wilburys album was written by Eric Idle, who gave himself the pseudonym Tiny Jampton, I think it is. I think it's Tiny Jampton, yeah.
Right, okay.
But you're right, there's definitely a daft sense to Traveling Wilburys. You know, I mean, we can call out the fact that, I mean, just the most notable ones of which are, you know, that they released two albums, Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 followed by Traveling Wilburys Volume 3.
Yeah.
The songs themselves have a certain, almost like verging on parody element to them. You know, it doesn't show up in this film, but there's the song Dirty World that is ostensibly about, I guess, sexy cars.
Yeah.
And it starts off with a line, something about your sexy body. And that started off by Bob Dylan saying that they should try to write a song like Prince.
Yeah.
You know, but for that to then turn into this familiar Wilburys sound that's a bit like sort of folksy skiffle, but still retain this element of sort of humour to it, but still, you know, all of the songs still stand up in their own right as actual songs. It's just a really interesting balance to strike. It feels like they've created, as much as they are an important and exciting supergroup that are recognised throughout music as being the greatest or biggest supergroup of all time, they almost approached it like they were creating like a novelty comedy band.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, giving themselves, like you say, like, you know, Wilbury nicknames and stuff. And
yeah, it's almost kind of like a gang you'd form at school or something like that, you know. and actually, like, you know, you kind of talk about that sound of theirs, and they are kind of, it's kind of funny that these sort of disparate influences, well, I mean, you know, they're all like men who play guitars and like rock and roll, but still they're all bringing something different to the table, and yet they have a kind of signature sound. It's that sort of 12-string acoustic sound, which is quite sort of driving in a way, not in the sense of, 20 best driving songs that you buy that you'd buy at Gordano Services or something like that. But that's very specific. That's the best place to get your CDs, Gordano Services.
Driving classics.
It's where I always go, yeah. But there is a kind of driving rhythm to it, and that guitar sound is very distinctive, you know, and it's the one that sort of, when McCartney wanted Jeff Lynne to come and work with him post Free as a Bird and Real Love, and so Jeff came and worked on Flaming Pie with him, and you can hear that Jeff Lynne influence in those songs, for example. So Young Boy in particular is very, very Wilburys kind of sound, you know.
Yes, yeah. And I think that I think it's interesting that what you have in, and what this documentary shows us, is that you know, they set themselves a task of writing and recording 10 songs in 10 days, and they approached it as a song a day. But what you have in that house, in Dave Stewart's house, is five guys with guitars.
So
there's a reason why the Traveling Wilburys has an overly guitar-y sound, because the first footage you see of them trying to write some of those songs all together is just all of them in a circle with guitars. It's just hilarious. Like, you've got Jim Keltner, who they brought in as a session musician to play drums, but essentially everything else is them, and their predominant instrument for each of them is the acoustic guitar. What I like about the, I don't know if it comes through necessarily in documentary, but what I like about the album that, you know, that gets explored here, is that Jeff Lynne as a producer, I think, finds ways to bring through the individual personalities and identities of each of the members of the group.
Yeah.
So with the opening song, Handle With Care, the song towards the end becomes almost like a sort of a trade-off between Bob Dylan's harmonica and George Harrison's slide guitar, which are two, you know, very distinctive instruments or sounds that are associated with those artists.
Yeah.
You have in, I think it's Rattled, where you have like Roy Orbison doing the I'm sure I can do it better than that. That he does in Pretty Woman. And also throughout all of it, I find as a big ELO fan, I find that there are very, very clear Jeff Lynne influences on a lot of the songs. You've got lots of sort of runs on synth and sort of like super uber backed up vocal harmonies and stuff. And so you've got this sort of this simplistic style that the band adopts. That you know, is this sort of folksy kind of sound that feels in tune with this idea of the Traveling Wilburys, but actually you also bring in these, you know, these identifiable elements of each of the group members as well, and I think that's just quite, it's quite a neat balance to strike.
It definitely is, yeah. And I think you know loads more about Jeff Lynne and ELO than I do, but you know, I always, it seems to be his skill as a producer. I mean, so he's sort of talked about as being that documentary about him where Paul and Ringo are talking about recording Real Love and Free as a Bird with him. They do talk about him as a sort of good diplomat, almost, you know, someone who's very aware that he's in a room with some very big egos and is good at striking the balance between making sure he's getting the best out of everyone and not upsetting the apple cart, so to speak.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that it's amazing that his work as a producer, I think maybe goes a little bit underrated.
Yeah.
I think he's worked on some, you know, really important albums for the period, not least of which obviously is before this album, Traveling Wilburys album. He had produced and co-written some of the songs for George Harrison's Cloud Nine, which is how the pair then met and then went on to form this group. I think when you say that I know loads about Jeff Lynne, I can't help but be reminded that I first started listening to ELO when I was very little, listened to my parents' record collection, and the name Jeff Lynne stands out to me because the first time I really took notice of that name is me and my brother, who's 4 years older than me, listening to these records and really loving ELO.
Yeah.
But always on the back of an ELO album, you would have lyrics by Jeff Lynne, music by Jeff Lynne, string arrangements by Jeff Lynne, produced by Jeff Lynne, catering by Jeff Lynne. Like, you know, it was just, and it would just become an in-joke between me and my brother about like how much Jeff Lynne is basically, you know, is ELO without us really understanding at that age. That he was, you know, and that's that. It just seemed like a funny thing that his name, he felt the need to credit himself so many times.
Right, okay.
But he is just this incredibly multi-talented, multifaceted guy when it comes to music. And it's clear with this, in this documentary, and it's clear in the documentary that you were talking about. And when we've seen him talk about anthology, that he never really seemed to lose that enthusiasm for the job at hand. You know, it always seemed to be something that he was not only adept at doing, but just really took a lot of joy from.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a real humility to him as well, in that you can tell that he's really bowled over by the fact that he's even been let in the room with people like this. You know, there's a lovely thing in, I don't know what this other documentary is called because I've only ever seen the YouTube clip of it. But I'm sure it's called The Jeff Lynne Story. Let's call it that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lovely bit.
ELO, is it me you're looking for?
Oh, that's ever so strong. the annoying thing, like, I was trying to think of one as well. He just immediately
came straight off the bat. This is not my first ELO pun off, my friend.
Mr. Blue, give me a minute. So the other documentary, there's a lovely bit in it where he's talking about when he's in there sort of producing Free as a Bird, and Neil Aspinall comes in, and first off he says he thinks it's amazing that Neil Aspinall's even speaking to him.
Yeah.
And he says, like, you know, like, John and George would, John and George, Paul and George would like you to come in and like check out the harmonies that they're doing. He's like, well, like me, check out the harmonies. Oh, I can't believe it. I'm sitting in this room. It's amazing, you know. And like, and it's lovely that way he speaks, because that accent is always quite disarming, right?
Yeah.
You know, it makes it incorrectly, of course, but like it gives you the idea that somebody is simple is not the word, but like well-meaning and sort of easily charmed. And you get that impression with Jeff, you know, like he can't believe he's been let in here. He just feels honoured to be there, you know.
Just the fact that he's excited that Neil Aspinall is called him, not alone that he's been asked to check on the harmonies between Paul and George, but just that he recognises the importance of Neil Aspinall's role. It's just incredible, isn't it?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's really difficult to talk about this documentary without going off topic and talking about the band as a whole. And maybe it's okay that we do that, but one of the things I feel about this documentary is that it's a shame that this is all we have.
Yeah.
So it's brilliant that we have it at all, obviously. Like, we, you know, first of all, it's a little bit difficult to decipher exactly what a documentary is, because it's made predominantly from home footage from 1988,
yeah,
at the recording. But actually, it was put together for a 2007 re-release of the album, and that's made clear when the credits roll at the end, I think. But it's a shame that for what is such a big event in rock music in terms of getting these icons together as a band, we only have these sort of 27 minutes that really documents that, and probably, yeah, not much more than that, because it was 10 days worth of material that they filmed shortly after the album's release. Obviously, Roy Orbison died. They obviously went on to release a second album, but it felt like it could have been the start of something bigger and something that lasted longer had it not been for Roy Orbison's death. So we have this milestone in sort of rock history of the Traveling Wilburys forming and releasing an album that they did Jeff Lynne says, from the writing of the first chord right through to the mix of the last chord lasted 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And we don't really have anything else to sort of register that with them. You know, it's great that we have this at all, but it just feels like a shame that it's only 27 minutes long, because it's such a monumentous achievement, I think.
Yeah, I think that it also feels quite fitting in a sense that, like I say, none of them really seemed to be treating it that seriously, or to be thinking, well, this is the next big thing in my career. You know, I think they all seem to just be happy to be along for the ride. And actually, a sort of 25-minute documentary, they never played any gigs, did they? Right?
No, not at all.
I presume not.
I think in terms of where they were in their careers at the time this happened, I think George Harrison was incredibly successful, was enjoying the success of Cloud Nine. I think Bob Dylan was much less so. I think he was actually coming off the back of some poorly received
The Christian albums, was it that?
I'm not sure.
Honestly, I don't know the Dylan timeline.
I don't know either, I'm afraid. I'm not as au fait with the Dylan discography. And then Roy Orbison, I think it's probably it feels like it's you're bringing on like an older musical icon into the mix.
Yeah.
Who probably, I think if I remember rightly, like he might have been at that time been going down the route of almost kind of like lounge singer status, where you're sort of churning out the hits and you're recognised for your voice rather than, you know, anybody sort of eagerly anticipating your new release. So actually what Traveling Wilburys did for everyone's career was sort of bring them back into the fold. It was a, you know, it was a well-received album and it kind of kick-started a lot of their, kick-started is the wrong word, but they were able to enjoy the success of Traveling Wilburys in their own individual solo careers off the back of that.
And
one of the reasons why there's a 10-day time limit is because Dylan's about to go on tour. They never really got a chance to capitalise on the success of the album. It was seen as a singular project that I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it surprised them, the success of it, in order for them to want to regroup for a later album, even after Roy Orbison's death. But I don't think there was any of the plans to turn it into a full-time gig.
No, it doesn't seem that way, does it? It's interesting to think of the idea that near the end of Let It Be / Get Back that George seems to be suggesting is that, well, I can just go off and do this solo album because I've got all this material. Mm. And maybe, you know, then we can get together. And you know, and there is a school of thought that if the Beatles had carried on, maybe they just would have been just going off and doing their own thing and then getting together and recording every 3 or 4 years when they fancied it, probably not playing any gigs, but just recording albums.
Mm.
When the mood took them, you know, and actually that seems to be what the Wilburys did.
Yeah, could have done. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it's probably a Traveling Wilburys. Probably they probably have an air about them which has a similar kind of like reputation for naffness, like Wings used to. You know, there's probably this idea that even at the time that it happened, they were, you know, older rock stars getting together and producing sort of traditional music. So there's probably a bit of a hint of, naffness to the whole project.
They're the band. The band could have been.
Yeah, the band. Yeah, exactly. They're the band that the Wings could have been, really, because we're looking at like sort of musical collaborations. I think that I think it probably stands them better in the long run that it was as short-lived as it was.
Yeah.
Because if following the success of their first album, they had decided to do more with it, then I think that might run its course with audience interest.
Yeah.
Sooner than maybe they would expect at the time. I think it's, you know, one of those things that becomes just like a fleeting moment. You know, it's a spark that shines brightly rather than for a long time. I think it's interesting, though, that, you know, when you're comparing it to the Beatles, and particularly comparing how the band members get on in this documentary compared with how the Beatles get on in Get Back or Let It Be, I think it's interesting that what you're saying about maybe the Beatles could have come back and recorded an album every now and again, I think the reason why this works is because it is that completely different dynamic.
Yeah.
And obviously, the answer to the question I asked at the start is that John and Paul wouldn't I think treat George the way that he wanted to be treated in the band as an equal.
Yeah.
You know? But also equally, I don't think Paul could have pulled together Traveling Wilburys. You know, he had the clout to, but I don't think he would have got in Jeff and Bob and Roy Orbison and Tom Petty and been a fifth of a band as opposed to the leader of a band.
Yeah, I think even if he tried to do that kind of thing, I think everyone would have recognised that they weren't going to be an equal, you know, like one fifth of an equal.
Yes.
Pie. Anyway, what, you know, whatever. you know what I mean.
Yes.
I think they all would have recognised that. And yes, I don't think he would have. I don't think McCartney would really know how to do that. Like, you know, the collaborations he has done. You know, you think about the Elvis Costello collaboration, which worked great up to a point, you know, and the point was when Elvis Costello started challenging him a bit too much, you know, and then it sort of fell apart a bit, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it makes sense, you know. I mean, they're all guys with egos.
The Beatles, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm sure Traveling Wilburys as well. Traveling Wilburys all seem to leave those egos at the door and are quite happy just to be thought of as equals. And it's really nice to see George in that environment. He's so relaxed, you know, and so easygoing. And he's just having a laugh with me. You know, there's a nice bit in the film where Jim Keltner is... he's just drumming on the fridge. He's got the fridge open. He's sort of drumming on the shelves, you know. Yeah,
for the song Rattled.
Yeah. You know, and this, and it was Dave Stewart's fridge, you know.
Yeah.
I had this image in my head of like him as like an Airbnb host, you know, and writing them a bad review because like his fridge shelves were all dented, you know. but there's a nice informality about that, and they seem to have set up microphones just in the kit. They were sort of recording in the kitchen anyway, where the acoustics can't have been great because it would have been too echoey. But they just seem quite informal and happy to do that. And then, you know, it sounds great when he drums on the fridge shelf. So let's stick that in. You know?
I think that's one of the things that's sort of most striking about the documentary is that, you know, this is the only, as I said earlier, the only footage that we have of the most important, you know, musical supergroup coming together in let's say in history and make it as grandiose as that. And actually, you know, you kind of wonder, well, how did the dynamics of that supergroup work? And as the documentary shows us, they're just five normal guys, right? They're just, you know, they sit around, they play the guitar, they're writing a song, change up a lyric or two, they have a laugh when they're singing it, you know, they mess about, they decide to record some bits, you know, here again on the fly. And it just, there's no like moment where you're struck by, oh, this is a genius, like, thing that's happening right now for the song. Yes. Even though arguably the five people in the room can be recognized as such. Yeah. There's no moment in documentary where you're like, oh yeah, this is, there's a moment where you see Bob Dylan playing the, or writing, I guess, in the moment, the opening chords for, I think it's Last Night.
Yeah.
And he's playing it. It's quite a distinctive rhythm that he's playing it. And he's showing it, I think, to Tom Petty, who then picks it up and, you know, then they're sort of playing it together. And I'm like, that's like the, that's like this documentary's equivalent of Paul writing Get Back out of thin air, right? You know, but you don't get that sense of it's a privilege to be in the company of actually the sight of this moment happening and forming. So it just feels very natural, and then they turn what they have into a good fun album.
Yeah, seems that way.
Yeah,
but I think also maybe there's this thinking about rock music that it has to be. That it has to be taken terribly seriously, you know. And you know, I mean, you think about that conversation people are always having about, oh, I think Maxwell Silverhammer and Obla Di Obla Da are terrible songs, and of course they're not terrible songs, they're brilliant songs. But I mean, the reason that people, men, always men, say that is because they think they're sort of children's songs or throwaway songs, and therefore they aren't serious enough, and this rock music has to be taken very, very seriously.
Like rock music in particular, like hard rock music with an edge, is what has real integrity.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, because it maybe stems from this idea that because the Beatles' original fans were sort of teenage girls, but then there comes a time when they all got into the studio and they started making proper, serious music, and now you can't scream and wet yourself over Revolver because it's too serious and it's too important, you know.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we're here now and we know how to appreciate this. And I think, you know, I mean, that that view of music, or I mean any art or culture, is incredibly dull, but it is nice when you see these sort of rock luminaries, you know, just getting together and not taking it too seriously at all, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody is in there saying, no, hang on, lads, let's stop having a laugh. This is a very serious thing we're doing here, you know.
And you know, it's probably, if you watch the documentary, I think one of the real highlights is when they absolutely like break down crying of laughter because of Roy Orbison ending up repeating a line, Trembling Wilbury, for Dirty World. And it is funny, but it's also, it's funny just him explaining it and then seeing them do it. And
yeah.
And it's also just because it's such a nice, it's a nice environment, nice atmosphere that they're recording that album in, where you've got five guys around a microphone. Like, you know, they're, you know, that's the extent to which they treated each other as equals. You know, there's no, we're not going to record everyone individually and then mix it in the track. Like, we're all going to stand around the microphone and do it together and take it in turns to do a line and
yeah, write yeah.
It just does feel like they've approached the whole project as a laugh, really. And actually, if nothing came out of it that they wanted to pursue, it would have just got shelved and they wouldn't have done anything, but they would have had a good 10 days off the back of it. And, you know, what's to say that's, you know, not a great thing in itself?
Yeah, it makes you wonder, I suppose, how many other projects like this there have been where musicians just sort of get together at someone's ranch for a few days and just kind of bash out a few songs and then see how it goes and it doesn't quite work out and then you just never hear about it.
Never hear about it until like the 50-year re-release remaster when they're running out of things to fill the box sets. Like that's a good point, actually, because there's a moment in the documentary which I found really interesting, which is Jeff Lynne is in his role as sort of, I guess, head producer of the project, seems to be, particularly in the finished product, I think, seems to be making what are ultimately sort of creative recording choices.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily songwriting choices, but, like, you know, as you would as a producer on a record, making choices around how the finished presentation of a song. And there's a moment in the documentary where they've written and recorded Not Alone Anymore, which is the big Roy Orbison number on the album. And then he explains how he decides to go back into the studio overnight and just completely re-record the guitar part using a different chord structure or a different chord progression for the song. Somehow doing... I mean, we don't know what the original was, right? There's no released version of what that original version of that song was,
right.
At least until the, you know, what we're up to, nearly 40-year anniversary.
Yeah.
But somehow he's managed to do that. He's had it in his head that actually, I've hit upon an idea, I think the song would work better this way. I'm going to go back into the studio by myself, re-record the music for this song in such a way that it still works with the vocals that they've already recorded, so the you know, everything's still in key at the right time. It needs to be for the whatever change in chord structure he's made there, and then play back to the gang the next day, and then, you know, they don't go so far as to say this. But presumably they're all like, yeah, you're right, it sounds better, that sounds great, well done.
Yeah.
He's just changed the whole song that they all wrote together and played and recorded.
Yeah.
And the next day he's like, I've actually changed a key part of it, and they're like, yeah, it sounds good. Nice work.
Well, there's a lot of confidence in doing that, and there's a lot of definitely feeling at ease in that company.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you can go, we were talking about the sort of reverence he felt when recording with the Beatles for the Anthology project, and 6 or 7 years earlier, he's in a studio with George and with sort of Bob Dylan and Roy Orbison, and just decides, like, oh, I'm just going to change this thing completely. Yeah. What do you reckon? You know, and like, there must be, like I say, that, you know, there is that kind of childlike enthusiasm around him where it feels very grateful to be in the room, but he also knows how good he is, right?
I think that's it. Yeah. It's that, isn't it? You're right. He manages to stay enthusiastic for the project. He manages to, I think, still be quite in awe of the company that he's keeping during that project. And yet at the same time, still manage to have a controlling hand in the creative choices that are made, like more so than I think probably any other person in that group, including George. Just because, like, he's the one that I think he was given the direction of how, you know, like I said, what the final presentation of each song is going to be. I think that's incredible. That's an incredible sort of confidence and skill to have.
Yeah, definitely. And I think maybe that's more of just sort of a producer's role, I would say. But I think, I don't think there is a leader to the Traveling Wilburys, but if there is, it feels to me like it's George. It feels to me like he's the guy in the room who is the most revered. Again, as we alluded to earlier on, he's a Beatle.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah. And that's enough, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's enough for a reason because he's done because of his contribution to the Beatles.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's a Beatle is what carries the most weight in that room.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not saying he seems a very eager collaborator. He doesn't seem to be stamping his own authority on it or anything like that, but he does seem to have been the guy who sort of got the thing together. He was sort of making the phone calls, you know. If you think about it, he's always had been aware of this clout of just whichever benefit concert it was, the people of Bangladesh,
yeah,
where, you know, he's just on the phone saying, well, we need Eric Clapton. And Clapton, I mean, is strung out on heroin, but still turns up a few days later. You know,
it's a problematic example to give at this juncture. But yeah, yes.
it's not the best example. You're right, but you know, he's completely aware with things like that he can just get on the phone.
But and that's also just because I think that a lot of that is down to his own ability to build those relationships with other musicians.
Yeah,
you know, like in a way that just I don't want to rag on Macca, but in a way that Paul McCartney didn't really, you know. We talked before when we covered off Wingspan about how Paul McCartney's approach to creating a new band was to just hire people that essentially served as his employees whilst in a band.
Yeah.
Whereas George has gone out and collaborated with other people, and he's built good relationships with other singers and songwriters and artists. So when the call comes in to see whether they can help support him in his course for Concert for Bangladesh, there's a friendship there that's already established, and those musicians are more than willing to help out a friend.
Yeah.
In the same way as, you know, approaching Traveling Wilburys, it's a, you know, these are people that have established a relationship beforehand, and then, you know, he hasn't called out, there's no one in this group that has been called out of the blue by someone they don't know.
Yeah.
With an idea of joining a band just because they're famous, you know, they it's all predicated on existing friendships and relationships.
Yeah, and nobody's threatened by the idea of working with George.
Mm.
You know, it's not like McCartney rings you up and says, "Do you want to collaborate on this thing?" Then obviously that's amazing, and you say yes, but you don't. But you're probably thinking, "Well, I know how this is going to go. You know, I'm going to play." The stuff I'm told to play.
Yes, exactly.
And
I'm going to turn up with 13 of my best ideas, and I'm going to end up playing his one idea.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Of course. You know, and
there's that story, isn't there? I think it was in Wings. Paul McCartney basically set a almost like a challenge for the rest of the bandmates about everyone coming back into like the studio with a song, and then they will choose the best song to be the B-side of their single, and ultimately he chose his own one.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Right. You know. yeah.
Just what a pointless challenge to say anyone. Like, what you've achieved there, Paul McCartney, is a waste of everyone's time and pissing everyone else off in the process.
Yeah, it's a bit like Ed Sheeran declaring the song war backstage.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah, it's very much like What a different world that these guys live in, where they just have musical-based challenges at every turn.
Yeah.
The documentary format is, here is each song presented in their in turn.
Yeah.
And the footage we have that went into each of those feels a little bit like each song is given equal amount of time. Makes me wonder whether or not that was the right approach. Like, you know, Handle With Care is the big number that everyone remembers. That's kind of brushed past a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't... Obviously, that was recorded before this session. So there wasn't any footage of them at Dave Stewart's house. There was no available fridge, as far as I'm aware, to drum on for the track. They recorded that completely separately from this whole album session.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's a strange thing as the big number from the album for them to just breeze past, and for them to give equal weighting to each of the album tracks, as opposed to sort of thinking about what are the bigger songs to explore in this doc.
Yeah, well, I wonder whether that was how much footage was shot of each one and stuff like that. And actually, when they got down to looking at what they had, I presume the brief was to make a very short documentary, so it could just be released on an enhanced CD or whatever it was.
Classic enhanced CD.
Yeah, it's good. It's it's absolute.
Put it into your CD-ROM and enjoy that 27-minute documentary. Yeah. After it loads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It reminds me of buying Wu-Tang Forever in 1997, and it came with an enhanced CD where you could look around the Wu Mansion. So, I loaded this up on Windows 95.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was just a thing where you'd click and you'd go into like the RZA's bedroom, and then he'd say something to you.
And he said something to you.
Yeah, they'd recorded like a couple of clips for it.
Wow.
But this was amazing technology back then, as far as I was concerned. You know. Sorry, I forgot how I got onto the Wu Mansion.
It depends on how much footage was shot for each of these. So I get that there's there's very limited footage of each recording. I realise that they're sort of putting together a documentary that looks at the album as a whole.
Yeah.
It just, it goes back to my original point. It just, maybe it's just me talking as a fan, but I just kind of wish that there was a 50-minute version of this documentary that gave sort of a bit more due reverence to some of the milestones that came along before and went set a little bit more context, just explained a little bit more and sold a little bit more the idea of why this was actually such a big deal at the time it happened. Because, as far as I'm aware, as far as I know, the album itself ended up being released with quite little fanfare. It wasn't a project that people were aware of before it came out. It was obviously released as the Traveling Wilburys. They've all got pseudonyms. It was released on the Traveling Wilburys' own record label, I believe. They'd set one up for the release because obviously, presumably, they're all tied into different recording contracts and stuff.
Yeah.
It just feels like something that came out and was a big deal, but actually there wasn't much in the way to remember it by.
Yeah, but I suppose the idea of it being a big deal is not something that any of them wanted to push. It seems they wanted to treat it quite casually, and I suppose if there'd been kind of any kind of marketing push behind it, then it might have just changed it all for them and turned it into something that they didn't want it to be. And I suppose that, as I think we said before, the fact that it's only 25 minutes long and it's sort of fairly thin and fairly casual is of a piece with the whole career of the Traveling Wilburys, everything they released and the way they approached everything, I know what you mean. You always end up thinking, well, I'd like a bit more of that.
Yeah,
if it's only 25 minutes long, you want a bit more.
Yeah. It just feels like it's the only footage. I feel quite sad now I'm talking about this now, that this is all we have.
Would you watch an 8-hour digitally remastered Peter Jackson version?
I'm waiting for it as we speak. I'm assuming that what you're just saying there about and treating it without wanting to get too hung up on the sort of the more serious business side of things reminds me of another excerpt from Hugh Jampton's liner notes, where he says, as the Wilburys began to go further in their search for musical inspiration, they found themselves the object of interest among many less developed species: nightclub owners, tour operators, and recording executives. To the Wilburys, who had only had just learnt to cope with wives, roadies and drummers, it was a blow from which many of them never recovered. It's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I just really enjoy that whole thing.
Yeah.
Out of interest, do you know why they're called Travelling Wilburys?
I do not.
I'm going to interest you with a great Wilbury factoid.
Okay, hit me.
During the recording of Cloud Nine, where Jeff Lynne obviously was a producer on that album with George Harrison, it became a bit of an in-joke that whenever there was something in the track that they didn't like, they would turn to each other and say, "We'll bury that in the mix." And Woolberry became the origin of the Travelling Wilburys name.
Oh, that's nice. I didn't know.
Isn't that
fun?
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. That's all I have. But to be fair, if I have one Travelling Wilburys factoid, it's a good one.
That is a good one. Yeah.
And I think with that factoid, I've exhausted all of my Travelling Wilburys chat around this documentary. Do you think it was a good experience watching the documentary?
Well, it's not about enjoying it. Films aren't there to be enjoyed.
Judging it.
Yeah, of course. You're supposed to judge it and analyse it to death. That's why we're here. And remove all fun from the experience.
The reason I ask is because it just seems like, I don't know, it just seems such a lightweight thing. And I've watched it many times, but I feel like I could watch it again right now, having watched it several times for this podcast.
Yeah.
And I feel like I would you know, I wouldn't be bored of it. It just seems like what, and just a nice, you know, it's a nice atmosphere. It has a nice tone to it all. It just seems, you know, just watching these five megastars just have a good time together. And I just, you know, it's just an enjoyable piece of content.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I did enjoy it, and I will say, I think the primary reason for that is that there's very few things I enjoy more than just seeing George in a good mood. You know,
rarely.
Yeah. But just having a laugh and enjoying himself, because every time I see sort of Beatles footage where they are having a laugh, there's always a bit of me that just thinks like, yeah, but what's underneath the surface with George? You know, there'll be some resentment there. The person he's talking to, there'll be a way in which he thinks he wronged him in 1964, which he hasn't let go of yet. You know, like there's always.
I mean, it sounds like you're painting a very unfair picture of George, but I'm hard pressed to argue with it.
Well, I mean, like, you know, he held a grudge. I'm not saying he was a grumpy. I mean, he was grumpy at times, but I'm not saying he. But I really like seeing him in an environment where he's completely comfortable. There is no beef or grudge against anyone else in the room, as far as you can tell. He feels completely at home, and he's enjoying himself, and he's in his element, you know. And there aren't, I often felt through some of his, not I was alive throughout his solo career, but like watching elements of his solo career, you can often feel like he was sort of going through the motions or trying to prove a point or something like that. And I think sort of Cloud Nine onwards, through Traveling Wilburys, and then the songs that were originally released posthumously on Brainwashed, which is an album I absolutely loved. I just think he is completely comfortable with what he's doing, isn't trying to prove a point to anybody, and sort of, you know, Cloud Nine, Traveling Wilburys onwards just seemed to arrived at a point where he was just very, very comfortable creatively, and I think that's a lovely thing to watch.
I think, yeah, I think it's a really good point. I agree with you. I find that George clearly feels, rightly or wrongly, that he's sort of, you know, been given the short stick a little bit. You know, he's been hard done by throughout the Beatles' career. And there's this sort of grumpiness factor that comes with that, which, you know, is something that gets just magnified a thousandfold when you're in the biggest band and one of the most famous people on the planet, right? People constantly telling, all you hear day in, day out is how amazing Paul McCartney and John Lennon are. And, you know, I imagine that feeds that sort of resentment. And I often find it quite hard to sort of reconcile that view of George with what I know to be the true of his fondness for that sort of Monty Python style of daft humour. And I think this documentary probably gives me the closest thing we have of both of those things coming together in terms of like his musicality and his sense of humour coming together into one project. So I think it's probably quite important that it shows that side of George and that sort of rounded nature of him as an individual, not just someone, him as a Beatle or an ex-Beatle. Anything else you want to add on the true history of the Travelling Wilburys?
No, I'm happy that is the true history of the Travelling Wilburys.
Finally, we have the true history. Okay, then let's wrap it up there. I hope you've enjoyed us talking about Travelling Wilburys. If you have enjoyed that, then please leave us a review and tell us that we're great, or at least help us with our podcast stats. You can also find us on various social media platforms using the handle @BeatlesFilmsPod. And either way, we will see you next week for another episode. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.